Estás escuchando Aftersight. Esta grabación está destinada solamente para personas ciegas y con baja visión.
La programación regular de este podcast no está disponible en este momento. Esperamos que disfrute de esta transmisión especial de AINC.
Listen News Hour. Thanks for listening.
This is the BBC.
KGNU 88.5 FM Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver.
KGNU presents our 37th annual Charles Sautel Memorial Mountain Jam fundraiser, Sunday, July 20th, noon to 5, in the Gold Hill Inn side yard. Join us for an afternoon of classic Americana sounds in a high-vibe, high-altitude outdoor setting. Foggy Mountain Spaceship and the Todd Livingston Unit will warm things up for headliners Rebecca Fraser and Becky Buller. Barbecue and cold beverages available to nourish your enjoyment. Kids are welcome. No dogs or coolers, please. Tickets and info at kgnu.org.
Support comes from the Colorado AFL-CIO, a federation of labor union members focused on providing representation for working people and representing members in the workplace. More information can be found at coaflcio.org.
Estás invitado a dar un pequeño paso con KGNU y Story Corp, el Proyecto Nacional de Historia Oral. Este programa reúne a personas desconocidas con puntos de vista diferentes para grabar una conversación facilitada de 50 minutos. No es un debate político, sino una oportunidad para conocerse como seres humanos. Si deseas participar, encontrarás más información y un breve cuestionario en kgnu.org.
¡Lucha! ¡Ahí viene la migra!
The struggle continues.
Welcome to La Lucha Sigue. The struggle continues. A bi-weekly radio magazine with a grassroots perspective on the news of Latin America and the Caribbean.
Una voz independiente somos.
This show was produced on June 15th, 2012.
Para representar la dignidad y la búsqueda de la paz.
A program is dedicated to giving a voice to our compañeras and compañeros who are struggling for social justice and equality.
In the news this week.
The nationwide crackdown on immigration enforcement and on various legal and political challenges are causing the migrant rights situation to develop rapidly as the Trump administration, which promised to target violent criminals, deploys military forces and massed officers across the country in deportation dragnets. The extent of the previously hidden role of migrants in the United States has been demonstrated by the growing number of cities where residents are rallying in support of the law-abiding undocumented immigrants who are being targeted in workplace raids. The vast majority of protests against the immigration crackdown have been nonviolent, but spontaneous marches and gatherings have occasionally included incidents of vandalism, violence, and looting. Nationwide, there have been hundreds of arrests for a wide range of charges, from minor offenses to felonies, with curfews being declared in areas that have seen extended disruptions. The mayor of Los Angeles, which has an overall area of nearly 500 square miles, has declared a curfew in a 1 square mile area of the city. We encourage our listeners to stay tuned to KGNU for updates on the rapidly evolving situation that involves our neighbors and the workers who affect every aspect of our lives. On tonight's show, we'll report on Mexico's unprecedented elections to elect 2,700 judges at all levels of the nation's courts. And we'll report on Cuba's response to the Trump administration's increasingly strict restrictions on relations with the Caribbean island nation. In addition, we'll look at the history of the Placita de Los Angeles and of neighboring Olvera Street, the founding place of the sprawling metropolis of Los Angeles, which has recently appeared in the news for being within the curfew area declared by the city's mayor. We'll also report on the killings of two journalists in Honduras and of the suspicious death of a journalist in Peru. We'll conclude tonight's show with a report on the recent conference for members of the European Parliament and for representatives of Latin American and Caribbean national legislatures who met in Lima, Peru, in preparation for an upcoming summit of national leaders scheduled for next November in Colombia.
Now the news.
The anti-deportation protests that began in Los Angeles on June 6th were largely focused on about a dozen blocks in the heart of the city, where the iconic Los Angeles City Hall is surrounded by the federal building and by a complex of government facilities, including various jails and detention centers. On June 10th, Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass declared an 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew in a one-square-mile area that includes Olvera Street, a one-block group of buildings and small shops where a small plaza commemorates the city's founding and the first Catholic church in the city, La Iglesia de Nuestra Señora la Reina de Los Ángeles, which was built in 1814, marks what was once the heart of a bustling community. At the southern end of Olvera Street, the Plaza de Los Ángeles, which is commonly known as La Placita, commemorates the founding of the city of Nuestra Señora la Reina de Los Ángeles de Río de Porciúncula in 1781 by a group of 44 settlers led by two Franciscan friars in an area closer to the Los Angeles River than today's plaza. After a series of floods, the original settlement was moved to higher ground where the plaza is now located at the foot of Olvera Street and in front of the 200-year-old church.
Over half of the original settlers would be considered black by today's standards, though the historical documents only say that 26 of the 44 settlers had some degree of African ancestry, while 16 of the settlers were described as Indios or Mestizos, and only 2 of the settlers were considered white or Spanish. The settlement was established on the site of an indigenous Yanagi village, which was repeatedly displaced and finally absorbed into the growing city.
Olvera Street was the scene of one of the first mass deportation raids in the U.S.'s modern history when, on February 26, 1931, federal immigration agents stormed the Placita and abducted over 400 men and women, forcing them into trucks and vans. In a 2001 article by Los Angeles Times staff writer Antonio Olivo that was published on the 70th anniversary of the 1931 raid, the author described then-new scholarly research into the causes and effects of the Placita mass deportations. Olivo noted that in their book, Decade of Betrayal, Mexican Repatriation in the 1930s, Long Beach Community College Professor Emeritus Raymond Rodriguez and Cal State University History Professor Francisco Valderrama wrote that officials later found that many of the deportees that they took to Mexico were actually U.S. citizens. The 1931 Olvera Street raid triggered a decade-long campaign during which 1 million people were deported, mostly persons of Mexican descent, many of whom were U.S. citizens by birth or by naturalization. The two historians found that officials later discovered that 60% of the deportees had been born in the U.S.
The deportation stopped with the start of World War II, when Mexicans and Central Americans were encouraged to travel north to the U.S. to work in the fields and factories due to shortages in the labor force due to the war effort. The modern history of the migrant rights movement, which is closely linked to the farm worker movement and to the Chicano rights movement, is continuously evolving as immigration raids and protests spread faster than we can report them.
Two Honduran journalists were killed on June 1st, bringing the total number of Honduran journalists murdered since 2001 to 110 homicides that have an impunity rate of over 95%. The first killing on June 1st occurred early in the morning when a well-known radio host and sports commentator, Carlos Gilberto Aguirre, was stabbed to death in the northern Honduran department of Olancho. Aguirre was reportedly killed in the small city of Juticalpa when he was run over by a hit-and-run driver. Aguirre was dead when emergency personnel arrived, but when they examined his body, they found that deep stab wounds had actually caused his death. As of June 13th, the perpetrators and the motives of the killing of the 68-year-old radio journalist and sports announcer are unknown.
The second killing also took place in the early morning of June 1st. Television journalist Javier Antonio Hercules Salinas was shot to death at around 4 in the morning in the western Honduran department of Copan when unknown assailants on a motorcycle ambushed him while he was driving his taxi through the small rural municipality of Santa Rosa de Copan. The gunman shot Hercules Salinas repeatedly, then fled, leaving him dead behind the wheel.
Born in El Salvador, Hercules Salinas had become a Honduran citizen 12 years ago, and, like many other working journalists in Latin America, he held a second job in order to make ends meet. 50-year-old Hercules Salinas covered organized crime for television news channel A Todo Noticias. The married father of two had a long history of being threatened due to his reporting. Hercules Salinas survived being kidnapped and beaten in September of 2023. He was subsequently granted special protective measures by the Honduran National Protection Agency. The Aguirre and Hercules Salinas killings have prompted a surge in concern over the fragility of the Honduran national system for the protection of human rights defenders, including journalists, members of the legal profession, and other vulnerable persons. The director of the Honduran Committee for Freedom of Expression, Armanda Ponce, said that the killing was evidence of the deficiencies in the government's protection system. Director Ponce of the Freedom of Expression Committee, which is known by its Spanish acronym as Sí Libre, said that Hercules Salinas was killed even though he had been granted special protection on five occasions.
Ponce noted that the state's special security apparatus functions very slowly and that it cannot respond appropriately in areas of heightened conflict and violence. Ponce explained to reporters that the protection mechanism does not consider the specific regional context of violence, which can be very different from place to place. For example, Ponce noted, in some places the main problem is drug trafficking, while in other places the main cause of violence can be corruption, illegal mining, extortion, or a combination of factors, with the result that each situation may require a unique solution.
Hercules Salinas was the second journalist who was receiving special protection from the state who has been killed in a little more than a year. Social communicator Francisco Ramirez Amador was killed in December of 2023 in the rural community of Danlí, which is some 60 miles southeast of the Honduran capital of Tegucigalpa. According to the Office of the Honduran Governmental Human Rights Commissioner, 101 media workers have been killed in the 24 years since 2001, an average killing of one every 3 months. The victims include reporters, photographers, camera operators, editors, announcers, engineers, and news directors, as well as newspaper, radio, television, and website owners. According to the Honduran Human Rights Commissioner, 88% of the killings of reporters and media workers remain unsolved and unpunished. On May 25th, the Honduran Human Rights Commissioner's office announced that the constant dangers faced by the Central American nation's media workers had reached such a level that it had declared that journalism should be considered a high-risk profession.
A Peruvian radio journalist was reported dead on June 2nd in the rugged Yungay district in the western coastal department of Ancash. Jorge Guerrero Soriano's body was found in an irrigation ditch by local residents who were watering their livestock. The Peruvian Journalists Federation described Guerrero Soriano as an outstanding radio journalist who was known for his commitment to his community and to the ethical practice of journalism.
His death is considered suspicious and is under investigation. According to witnesses, the last time that Guerrero Soriano was seen alive was at around 11 in the morning of June 2nd, when he left a social gathering with another person. Guerrero Soriano's father said that his son's body bore no obvious wounds, but that it is possible that he was intentionally drowned. There are no known reports of Guerrero Soriano receiving death threats, but the management of Radio Maravilla, where he worked, considered his killing to be a murder and demanded an effective investigation into the mysterious death.
The 50-year-old father of two was well known after years of local broadcasting and for his commitment to reporting on the issues that affected the region's residents. Guerrero Soriano's body lay in state during the wake, which was held at the Radio Maravilla studios where he had worked. There were no reports of suspects or of a motive being identified in Guerrero Soriano's death.
A tuned into La Lucha Sigue, a bi-weekly radio magazine of Latin American and Caribbean news from a grassroots perspective. Later on tonight's program, we'll report on the Trump administration's increasingly repressive policy toward Cuba and on the recent conference of parliamentary leaders from the European Union, Latin America, and the Caribbean. But first, we have an update on the results of Mexico's unprecedented June 1st judicial elections. In the United States, state judges can be selected through partisan elections, nonpartisan elections, or by appointment, depending on the state and on the level of the court. Federal judges are nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate.
Mexico's ruling Morena party will gain control of the Supreme Court and of most of the country's other courts as a result of the June 1st judicial elections. The June 1st vote was the first time in Mexican history that its citizens directly elected some 2,700 judges who will be part of the country's judicial branch for the next 10 years. As of June 13th, candidates linked to the Morena party won most of the contested judgeships amid an unusually low voter turnout and allegations of political corruption.
After the new judges take their seats, the Morena party will control every branch of Mexico's tripartite government, which, like the U.S., is composed of supposedly independent legislative, judicial, and executive branches. According to critics, Morena's control of the three branches of government threatens the integrity of Mexico's system of checks and balances. Opponents of the judicial election insist that the independent authority of the courts could be compromised by criminal interests and by corrupt officials. The unprecedented election of over 2,000 judges at every level, from local magistrates to Supreme Court justices, makes Mexico the only country on earth in which all of its judges are popularly elected.
Voter turnout was much lower than the over 60% participation in Mexico's 2024 general election, with only about 13% of the country's 100 million eligible voters casting a ballot. The low turnout was blamed on a boycott of the election by opposition parties and the problems on implementing such a large-scale operation for the first time.
A political research professor at the Autonomous University of Mexico, Victor Manuel Alarcón Holguín, told reporters that the electoral authority's organizational protocols were poorly defined, so election officials often had to improvise solutions to technical problems. CNN reported that many voters were overwhelmed by the large number of positions and candidates from which they had to choose. The National Electoral Institute established some 300 district councils in Mexico's 32 states, which coordinated activities among almost 84,000 polling places. There were nearly 170,000 accredited election observers, along with at least 375 international observers from 40 nations and from some 16 international organizations. President Claudia Sheinbaum insisted that voter participation in the June 1st election met expectations, while critics noted that with only 13% of voters participating, many, if not most of the judges could have been elected with the approval of less than 10% of their constituents.
Mexico's president acknowledged the problems in the June 1st vote, and she promised that her administration will improve the process for the second phase of the judicial elections, which are scheduled for 2027. Opposition parties and many grassroots organizations criticized the judicial elections and said that eliminating corruption was merely an excuse by Sheinbaum's Morena party that permitted the party to consolidate power. Three of the nine winners in the Supreme Court race are sitting justices, who had been nominated by former President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the founder of the Morena party.
Three of the other winners in the race for Mexico's Supreme Court include a former legal advisor to López Obrador and the Sheinbaum administration's human rights prosecutor. The Supreme Court's next president, the equivalent of the U.S.'s Chief Justice, is an indigenous lawyer who is also linked to the Morena party. The Autonomous University's Alarcón Holguín noted that, while many of the judicial candidates do not have an obvious affiliation with Morena, they do have interests, connections, or ideological affinities which suggest that they are the party's political allies. adding to concerns about the Supreme Court. All of the 9 candidates who are connected to Morena appeared in pamphlets that party members distributed to voters. The pamphlets reportedly promoted pro-Morena candidates, even though the election regulations prohibited political parties from promoting or from supporting judicial candidates.
Mexican President Sheinbaum, the leader of Morena, has distanced herself from the pamphlets, condemned their use, and called for an investigation into their production and distribution. Then-President López Obrador and Morena approved the judicial election in September of 2024. Shortly after then-President López Obrador announced the judicial election, 8 of the justices who sat on the then-11-member Supreme Court announced their resignations, and they boycotted the June 1st election.
You're listening to La Lucha Sigue, a bi-weekly radio magazine of Latin American and Caribbean news produced at KGNU. We'll conclude tonight's show with a report on the recent conference of parliamentary leaders from the European Union, Latin America, and the Caribbean, who met in Lima, Peru. But before we get to that, we'll report on Cuban Foreign Ministry warnings of increased hostility from the Trump administration. On June 3rd, the Deputy Director for U.S. Affairs in Cuba's Foreign Ministry accused the Trump administration of escalating tensions between the U.S. and Cuba, and she expressed concerns that the Trump administration is trying to provoke a military confrontation between the two nations. Speaking at a press conference at the Cuban Embassy in Washington, D.C., Deputy Director for U.S. Affairs Johanna Tablada told reporters that the Cuban government wants to ease tensions, but that the U.S. appeared to be determined to damage relations further.
U.S. Affairs Deputy Director Tablada said that new Trump administration sanctions targeting Cuba are intended to rupture relations and to create conditions for a military confrontation. U.S. President Donald Trump has taken a hard-line approach to Cuba since he returned to office on January 20th. President Trump has rescinded various measures that former President Joseph Biden implemented during his last days as president. In one of his first actions upon returning to office, President Trump returned Cuba to the State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism.
The top U.S. diplomat in Cuba, U.S. Chief of Mission Mike Hammer, has reportedly traveled across the island to meet with political dissidents, prompting the Cuban government to accuse him of trying to foment political tensions. In late May, the Cuban Foreign Ministry warned U.S. Chief of Mission Hammer that inciting Cuban citizens to commit criminal acts is a violation of the Vienna Convention norms on diplomatic relations. In her June 3rd press conference, Cuban Deputy Director for U.S. Affairs Tablada accused Hammer of channeling U.S. humanitarian funds to groups that seek to undermine the Cuban government. Tablada said that the U.S. government would never permit Cuban diplomats to engage in similar behavior in the U.S. Although President Biden is credited with revoking the first Trump administration's unilateral sanctions against Cuba, the Democratic president did not do so until January 14, 2025, less than 1 week before he left office. During the 3 years and 51 weeks of his fourth term, however, President Biden kept Cuba on the state sponsors of terrorism list, and he kept Trump's first administration sanctions in effect.
Nearly 100 legislators from Europe, Latin America, and the Caribbean met in Lima, Peru, for the 16th European Latin American Parliamentary Assembly that was held from June 1st through June 3rd. The 3-day assembly was held to prepare for the upcoming 4th summit of the European Union and of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, which is scheduled for the 9th and 10th of November in Colombia.
The head of the European section of the Bi-Regional Association of National Lawmakers, Gabriel Mato, said that Europe and the Americas share 4 main issues: organized crime, climate change, immigration, and reviving multilateralism. The head of the Latin American section of the Legislators Association, Salvadoran Deputy Carlos Hernandez, applauded a series of trade agreements between the European Union with Chile, Mexico, Central America, and the Southern American Common Market, which is known by its Spanish acronym, Mercosur. Hernandez, who is a member of El Salvador's ruling Nuevas Ideas party, acknowledged the investment of 45 million euros in Latin America by the European Union's Global Gateway Initiative, but he noted that additional aid would be needed to resolve the crisis in Haiti. The Vice President of the European Parliament, Spanish member Javi López of the Catalunian Socialist Party, inaugurated the 16th European Latin American Parliamentary Assembly by highlighting the importance of immigration for its economic benefits and for its cultural enrichment. The Latin American, Caribbean, and European legislators and their guests applauded López when he said that the Israeli blockade of Gaza was an example of collective punishment. López said that it was unacceptable that 56,000 Palestinians had been killed in the 21 months since October 7, 2023.
Latin America and Europe have been two of the world's regions that have been most supportive of the Palestine rights movement. The European Union, Latin American, and Caribbean Parliamentary Conference took place 1 week after numerous European Union members, led by France and Spain, rejected Israeli policies and actions against the Palestinian people of Gaza and of the West Bank. Various Latin American heads of state, in particular the leaders of Brazil, Chile, and Colombia, have supported Palestinian demands for an end to hostilities and for a permanent ceasefire that will allow people to rebuild their homes and communities.
Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, Chilean President Gabriel Boric, and Colombian President Gustavo Petro have been three of the most vocal critics of Israel's policies toward Palestine. On May 29th, the Brazilian government condemned the Israeli announcement that it will build nearly two dozen new settlements in the Palestinian territory of the West Bank. President Lula, long known for supporting Palestinian self-determination, has accused Israel of genocide, resulting in his being declared persona non grata by the Israeli government. Chilean President Gabriel Boric has also opposed Israeli policies, describing Israel's actions in Gaza as genocide and as ethnic cleansing. At his annual presidential report to the nation, President Boric told a joint session of Chile's bicameral Congress that it was urgently necessary to boycott Israeli products from the occupied Palestinian territories and to embargo military trade and aid to Israel.
President Boric said that Chile had joined with Mexico in a joint request to the International Criminal Court for an investigation of the Israeli government for war crimes and for crimes against humanity in Gaza, an action that resulted in arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister, for former Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. The 125 International Criminal Court member states are now required to arrest Netanyahu and Gallant if they enter their territory.
In May, President Boric recalled Chile's ambassador to Israel, withdrew Chile's military attachés, and suspended Israel's participation in an upcoming defense and aerospace exhibition. With a population of between 500 and 800,000 persons of Palestinian descent, Chile has the largest Palestinian community outside of the Arabic regions of southwestern Asia and of northeastern Africa. Colombian President Gustavo Petro, who has called Israel's actions genocide, recalled the Colombian ambassador and broke diplomatic relations with Israel in May of 2024. 1 year later, on May 26th of 2025, Colombia, which first recognized the state of Palestine in 2018, named its first ambassador to Palestine, and Colombia established an official embassy in the Palestinian interim capital city of Ramallah. Although Mexico has condemned the violence and urged Israel to allow humanitarian aid to reach the population, the government has avoided actions that might affect its economic ties to the U.S.
You've been listening to La Luciega, produced at KGNU.
We'd like to thank Tom Moore and Nancy Zillow for production assistance.
Our host.